Let a bottle pig say, show you what to do, and this is what he'll tell you. If you got a problem, to know who you are here now, this is what you do. Remember, you are me, I am you, all of us together.
With simplicity, all that happens to you, and welcome to the Naked Short Club on Resonance FM. I am Dr. Stu, your host. We're coming to you live from Athens, Master Engineer Mr. Chris Dixon at the controls with us. Expert guests here to talk dirty about hedge funds, markets, the economy, and wider world here at the Cafe Syriza, where the righteous leftish indignation of this overextended, debt-crippled nation has defaulted in a Tina world of no alternatives to a revolutionary alternative that looks and walks and quacks like a default. Bye-bye Merkel's austerity, hello prosperity, by sheer magic, kazam! But let's be of good cheer. Each of us has here a foaming glass of the delicious products of our corporate sponsors, made of premium Ponzi beer. Life is a bowl, if not of cherries, then of Dr. Stew's extra large pastorma. So guests, raise those glasses, eat my big fat spicy sausage, and tell me, how are you dressed?
We're naked, Dr. Stew.
Well, put your big, fat, spicy sausages away, and while we work out what to talk about, Mr. Chris Dixon, let's have some music.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Naked Short Club on Resonance FM. That was Popol Vuh, and I am Dr. Stu, your host, here in Athens with Andrew McCaffrey, Global Head of Alternatives Aberdeen, who may share with us his recent experience at Davos. Eric Bissonnier, co-CIO Alternatives at Multi-Managers Gotex, for whom as a Swiss resident, Mayfair is a slum. Leandros Kalisperas, Strategy Coordination at USS, Britain's largest occupational pension scheme, and Richard Edwards, CEO of CTA Managers, Head Capital, one to watch. For poetry, Pelle Cox, formerly Poet in Residence at the Tate Modern and Royal Academy of Art, and now in our dreams, Poet in Residence at the Naked Short Club. Now, let's get speculating. So, Andrew McCaffrey, what's going on?
Well, Dr. Stu, much on my mind at the moment. One of the key things is, are there any financial assets that are inexpensive now? I think it's an interesting first month when you see so much that has occurred, that you've seen European stock markets doing very well, thanks to the ECB, but you've seen the US down in a January, closing negative. What does that mean? And I suppose, comes from this is that what does the consensus truly believe as we start to build out 2015? Reflation versus deflation. What would another round of US dollar strength mean as we're starting to see the first effects and the loss of profitability in some of the US companies? And if all this means less certainty, more volatility, and coming out of a better dispersion environment that hedge funds and many traders have been able to take advantage of, are there more opportunities for alpha, or are we going to find some risks that lay below the surface as the year develops?
Cool. Thanks for that. There's just a little hint of a bear, a very fine bear in a very fine forest there. Come back to that soon enough. Now, Richard Edwards, what's going on with you?
Howdy, Stu. I've been thinking about governments this week, and I'm a bit puzzled, I must say, because we have seen the beginning of money printing in Europe, not this week, but last. And there's a kind of feeling of here we go again about this. The American government printed a lot of money to get us out of trouble in 2008 and then found they had no other policy options, so kept doing it. Britain followed suit, as we always do with everything the Americans do. China followed in a little way. Japan came next. And now finally Europe, which might, of course, be, in many people's view, too little, too late. But there is an uncomfortable theme here, is there not, which is that big government, which has been, by some measures, the bane of life throughout the 20th century for its capacity for evil, is now with us in yet another reinvented form. And it may well be that we have a new normal here and that central banks, the organs of the state, after all, are going to be perpetual players on a very large scale in markets. And I think that very few people are thinking that this is the new normal. Most people are thinking, well, when things get back to normal, when QE finishes, but is it going to?
Kimo sabe, and who knows? But of course, Richard, there are those who actually think that there is a new normal that's emerged over the last generation or so, a neoliberal normal where there's a lot of storm and drang about big government, but actually it's being progressively pared back in terms of the ways in which it intervenes in our lives. More about this later. Now let's go over to you, Eric Bissonnier, and tell us what's on your mind.
Well, I'm worried, Dr. Stu. After 2008, 2009, I was worried. First of all, my daughter was becoming a teenager, but also that we were going to witness the limits of democracy, and that if the policies that were put in place were not going to work, then we're going to end up with some extremist government, the most fearful ones probably nationalistic, which would lead to all kinds of problems to summarize the thought, problems towards the euro or towards Europe in general. And obviously, I'm seeing this from Switzerland, which is even more worrying. But more generally, also being French, I'm worried about Europe itself and that everything that's been built so far was going to go down the wrong way, because of democracy in a way. When that's what worries me, because it seems to be converging this year.
Well, I suppose we have nothing to worry about. You know, people like Fidesz in Hungary and their Croatian equivalents, no one would say that they verge on being, well, let's not use the F word. Anyway, Leandros, what's going on with you?
Well, I'm not really worried, actually, Dr. Stu. Obviously, as you know, I have a deep Greek heritage, and I'm very happy to be buying you all a coffee here in Athens. I will obviously charge you individually later. But
do you mind paying taxes, or is that not really the done thing here?
I guess I'll just ignore that. But
and actually, you know, which royal family on the other side of the Mediterranean seems to have half its members being arraigned for tax fraud? And there's other royalty stories we could come up with, like, for example, which member of the royal family, of hedge fund royalty in the UK is denying? Well, anyway, that's another story. Let's carry on.
I guess sort of Eric and Richard are picking up a similar theme. And I guess it might be interesting, one, to look at perhaps whether governments are players, but actually to look at whether voters are actually ahead of the curve rather than behind it. It's been quite interesting to me, at least, to note that actually quite a lot of sympathy stroke empathy for what actually Greek voters have decided. So I'm actually slightly less concerned on that. I think on the market side, I do just wonder whether actually sort of 7 years on from the crisis, even though we do have this marginal player, I do just wonder that fundamentals actually may be reasserting themselves. And I think the reason it might happen this time is that I think people have actually got onto a common platform in terms of their understanding of where we are. And I think at that point, fundamentals can actually be a bigger driver. So that will obviously have implications for certain strategies.
And Leandros, interesting that this is one of those additions where I don't think everyone's quite on the same page around the issues that have been raised as one another, which is good. Not that I want you to argue. I want free love and more nudity. But seriously, as long as you take it a little easier than any of you have on previous editions with that Madoff premium Ponzi beer, then we should be okay. Now, I should point out to listeners that two of you plutocrat drunks, Eric and Andrew, will actually be speaking at this week's AlphaScope conference in Geneva, at which, as it happens, Dr. Stu will be chairing on one of the days. And not out of self-interest, I would say it's probably about the top quant conference in Europe this side of the summer. And there are a few, very few delegate passes left. So if you are intent on going, check out the AlphaScope website. And for the largest discount in the industry, quote the secret Naked Short Club code A, Dr. Stu. Claim that discount. And as mentioned last week, if you are worried about prices in Geneva following the hike in the Swiss franc, there will be organized scavenging parties, visits to food banks, and some of us will stand on the Rue de Rhône as the Russians come out of those private banks with their bulging suitcases full of newly converted cheap dollars. And depending on, you know, what currency of denomination your home base is in, like the people from the UK will be able to hold up signs saying sterling denominated hedge fund manager will generate alpha for food. Whether the Russians will understand what the heck you're talking about is another matter. Anyway, I think it's time for another round of that wonderful Madoff premium Ponzi beer. And also, let's have some poetry from Pelle Cox, who, unlike you guys, doesn't know what she's talking about.
Hello. I have a godson who will inherit a vast stately home, and part of my godmother duties is to write him a poem. Every time I see him, this is the one I wrote for him from this New Year's shoot. It's called Sitting with the Men in the Cigar Room. I have been asked to sit with the men in the cigar room. Bismuth shot, supreme game, Grand Prix. I had not been out that day to see. I had not been. So this is definitely a man's room. Here I am, like the bell with no sting. like those birds shot and piled high, their long songs gone. If I could beat them out of their glass, like the wine has beaten me, the long fallen scent, their shapely knees, I sit in the plumes of these, writing like their still, fierce beaks could steer me.
Great poem, Pelle, but honest to goodness, do you really think it was right to tell the entire world, all our listeners out there, that Master Engineer Chris Dixon lives in a stately home? It was his little secret with you. Anyway, slow it down with that Ponzi beer, you guys, and do try and enjoy these delicious vanilla hazelnuts from our latest and tastiest corporate supporter, the Naked Nut Company of Visalia, California. Only 5,245 clicks direct west of here. As they say back in California, crunch, yum, delicious. Now, lots to talk about while we gather our thoughts. Mr. Chris Dixon, let's have some music.
She, am I right? I want some, but tonight. I want some, alright. But she can't help, because she's not right. No, 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 no. It's always, and it's always this way. I am not right. She wants something, she wants something tonight. She wants something, she wants something. All right, oh, but I can't help, because I'm not right. No. And it's always, and it's always this way.
Welcome back to the Naked Short Club on Resonance FM. That was the Stooges before Iggy Pop got famous, when the guest said, gosh, that was gentle like a Detroit lullaby. Go figure. Anyway, I am Dr. Stu, your host, and engineer Mr. Chris Dixon is at the controls. Now, listeners, as you know, you're tuned to not-for-profit Resonance FM, which is London's leading voice of radio art. What else? The arts, the particular, and the unexpected. Nearly 3 million listeners worldwide. Now, we have our annual fundraising week coming up from February 9th to 15th. We are, on the one hand, going to have an online auction. Again, that's from the 9th to the 15th of the month, where there are some absolutely amazing things that you can bid for, and the proceeds go to the station. Equally as ever, we will accept your donations to keep the station on the road. So look out for that. There is a dedicated fundraising site called fundraising@resonancefm.com. Unless I've got it wrong, I'll probably have to correct myself later. Anyway, let's continue that earlier conversation, starting with Richard.
Hi again, Dr. Stu. I may have an answer for you, Andrew. You were looking for suggestions for what assets may be cheap. And I think maybe food. Now, some years ago, there was a lot of fuss about food prices rising, and sure enough, they did. And there was some interference from policy. So corn, what we would call maize in Europe, was grown for its ethanol potential instead of being grown as human food or animal food. And so that artificially inflated that price. Soybeans went up because of demand from the Chinese, who suddenly discovered a taste for meat, and you need a lot of soybeans to make a cow. But in the meantime, there's been a lot of profit-taking in those grains. And wheat prices are now down to something not far above where they were before this madness started. And of course, in the background, you've still got population ticking upwards. World population currently crossed 7 billion last year, heading for 9 billion, possibly 10 billion in 30 years' time. And of course, more mouths to feed mean more need for food. And there is no more land being discovered. And the good land is largely used up. So American agricultural traders are used to looking for periods when the marginal land is being planted, when rocky, stony ground that won't support seed growth is finally being cultivated. And I believe that's happening. So we have right now a situation where some grain prices are down, probably temporarily, but the background demand is there. Unlike financial assets, which have been pushed up and up and up some more and up again and up some little bit more. So I would say that might be a suggestion.
Interesting. Interesting angle. Now, maybe the droves of people that are out of job will start to eat maize instead of, and that will push up prices, right? That could be a possibility. I think what I was mentioning before, if we think of in terms of an investment angle, the political reality creates uncertainty, and as we know, we're uncomfortable with uncertainty as investors. But we're not going to escape it. So the big question is, how do we maneuver the doubts or the uncertainty that we have in the next couple of years in various elections, and how can we trade this? And it's very difficult because the outcomes are all binary. And binary outcomes, if you want to trade them, are very expensive. You can buy options on both sides, but then nothing happens and you've lost everything. And if something happens, you look like a hero. The problem is that it's again for yourself as a business kind of binary. You may lose everything or you may make some money from something. So I think the very big challenge over the next 12, 18 months is how to maneuver this uncertainty and still make money in the meantime, because you can't just wait. And that's a very key element to the year to come.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was reading, I think it was one of those Bloomberg views from Mohamed El-Arian this morning, sort of suggesting that volatility was back in January. But then when you actually went and looked at what he was talking about, it didn't seem to hold true. So there's perceptions of volatility increases and so on. And obviously Eric picks up quite rightly that sort of a lot of option values are in the tails. I guess in terms of where can one not be binary in terms of investment themes, and I guess it's where there is, I would say, some credit products are likely to still maintain some spread tightening. It obviously depends where you look. It depends where real yields are in different economies and so on. But even though it's certainly not going to be as attractive as some of the sort of convergent spreads we've seen in recent years, I think there are areas where effectively default rates will remain low. And it pains me to say it because they've been low for so long that at some point they do have to rise. I do believe that's something where there's not there's not going to be the binary outcome which credit often can exhibit.
Okay, I know Richard is jumping up and down and wants to intervene, but first, Andrew.
Just really, it's picking up on Leandra's point that I think one of the things that is going to be very interesting is that generically, as I said, a lot of financial assets are expensive. I'm afraid I tend to think a lot of credit markets are, but it's the idiosyncratic opportunities that still exist. And there's a, still the wave of bank disintermediation that we've seen, since the crisis is ongoing. And that will throw up a certain number of opportunities, which are credit link that I do believe will be very attractive, but will be ever more specific and need to be explored by skill and a great deal of knowledge rather than just being broadly available.
The main worry I have for credit, and we started to see that in December and last summer, is the you talked about disintermediation, and that's clearly a opportunity, but it means there are no dealers when the market starts to get tricky, and it was bad in 2008 when there were dealers. I'm not suggesting we will go back to that. So I actually think we don't even need that for the market to disappear, and that's because dealers are gone. So disintermediation is a good thing because it creates opportunity on the idiosyncratic side, and also, the spreads that were done by the banks can now be done by the managers that we invest in. On the other hand, if there is a problem, the door will be very, very narrow, especially in high yield.
My thought on credit, Dr. Stu, is that there's a huge dislocation here. We have very low yields on bonds. Bond prices have been pushed up because of quantitative easing, artificial money creation, and as a result, as every bond dealer knows, the price of the bond goes high means the yield of the bond goes low. The reward for holding the bond is the yield. The danger of holding the bond is default. We all know, at least I think we know, that quantitative easing and its other cousins in money creation do very nicely for asset prices, push bond prices higher, push stock prices higher, put real estate prices higher, but very little for real growth, real economic activity. And it's the real economic activity which pays for the repayment of the bond. And so currently in credit markets, you have very low yields and increasing risks. Even though default rates may not yet have gone up, when they do go up, they will go up a lot. So to me, it seems like a crazy one-way bet. But when it'll come true, who knows? 1 year? 6 months? Sooner rather than later, I suspect.
Yeah, I think I'd like to just differentiate between trading credit securities and to pick up on the point of liquidity, which I totally agree is that below the surface, the ever-growing lack of dealer intervention may mean that there's more gap price risk as you see greater flows from a lot of money that's flowed into to these securities. But the area I really was pointing to was very much private market, and direct lending opportunities, that ability to be much more specific, still extract value out of higher quality opportunities. And the reality is you are taking on an illiquidity premium to play in that space, and that's one of the items that stands out. The reality is, though, it is limited capacity. It is limited to a few who can access. But if you can, I think that's one of the areas that still exists where there is some value. The reality is, around any illiquidity or systemic risk is that if they go, they go very much hand in hand. And if we were to have a much broader systemic problem again, I suppose the bigger issue back to liquidity for credit and for all markets is going to be that we've moved from an environment where there are a significant amount of price makers, and now we've moved to an environment where it's almost all price takers.
So, Andrew, do you mean situations where one would replace the banks, like crowdfunding, or do you mean special situations where an investor seeks an investment and somebody is prepared to pay a decent coupon on a bond in order to get that investment? Are you talking about private placement or a replacement system?
Yeah, I'm talking about where you're finding that capital has basically managed to find its way into small, medium-sized companies, direct credit facilities, so loan facilities, revolving credit, all different aspects which basically are replacing the bank, which no longer is given the balance sheet. And this is not about creating securities and then selling them off in a public market. It's very much about a direct lending
opportunity. So the Chinese Chinese system, the parallel Chinese system, you think will be replicated around the world?
I think that the reality is that it's always been there in a small way. The banks and the power of fractal banking managed to displace that. It's come back with a vengeance as capitals seek out opportunity, and the banks have not been there to fill in that need from the small and medium-sized corporate market.
I think it's great. I don't know if it's just because we're in Athens and you're buying my coffee, but we're sort of talking all about credit, which is wonderful. Apologies, Dr. Stu, but I'll just continue it for a little bit and then move on to sort of more interesting topics. But seriously, on credit, I think one of the things that that gets a little bit lost in this debate is that, as Eric says, we're in a period of quite a lot of uncertainty, and then how do you trade that? But no one seems to speak too much about sort of asset allocation and where we are in terms of, the risk-return spectrum. And, credit sits in between equity and fixed income for a reason in terms of the risk-return profile. And in a period of uncertainty where at one end, fixed income is off a 30-year bull run and equities have been propped up by QE, it actually seems fairly intuitive to me that actually credit could be a moment to actually perform. I would sort of defend that. I'm not sure if Richard wants to pick that up or whether we sort of link into other topics.
Well, you nail it right. What is the proper asset allocation environment? And I'm taking it from a Swiss perspective, where 10-year bond yields are minus 10 basis points. What is the right asset allocation? So we have tight spreads, very low yields, equity markets, which arguably are, and we probably don't want to argue this here, but are expensive to some extent, or at least fully priced. Now, if I take it precisely on an asset allocation basis, and I want yield, you look at what you would want to avoid, and we talked about liquid credit or high yield investment grade, which are not paying, bonds, which are not paying. Where would you want to put your money? So there's liquidity premium, and we started to explore direct lending, but there's obviously many more investments that pension funds are doing, such as infrastructure and other many other things, real estate. And on the other hand, what else is there that's more liquid? It's equities. So if you kind of in an asset allocation framework and you think about investors that have continuous flow in, where would they have to put the money? Are they going to put it in bonds and lose money, or almost mechanically put it in credit, liquid credit, which will maybe a problem down the road, or find a way into equities where they know they can get out tomorrow with some gap, but with some diversification they can get there. And also this starting to be discriminate, which means that it starts to have bring opportunities at the stock level, which is actually good for the managers that are actually doing stock picking, whether it's systematically or fundamentally. So I think it could be argued both ways that credit could be interesting, but also that actually equities are going to continue like this as long as we have low yields, which is, as we know, good for companies generally and current earnings, and we have some form of QE or, let's say, controls on how the market is behaving. The Japanese being the most extreme example of how you can prop up a market.
Yeah, I agree. I certainly agree with Eric that it could be fundamental, whether it's equity, credit, or anything else. Maybe to pick up Andrew's challenge at the beginning, what is the consensus? I don't know, but I do have a feeling that we're all more educated about where we are in the world than we were, and that may provide an opportunity for fundamentals to work. I guess I would throw up a question which I'd be interested in the views of others as to, and again, it does pick up Andrew's point around deflation. I think there does feel like there might be a consensus around that. You don't hear the Austrian economists too much at the moment talking about the effects of QE on inflation. I think some people may have picked up that QE actually could be actually structurally deflationary, just given the transmission mechanisms. And to the extent that we've also got what's happened with oil, I just wonder whether deflation is a consensus. If it is, it's a consensus that doesn't actually need to be reversed, because the manner of it suggests that it doesn't have to unwind itself, unlike other consensus trades. I wonder where deflation takes you in terms of trading ideas.
Inflation. Inasmuch as I ever pay any attention to economics, I've always found the arguments of the old-timer Milton Friedman most attractive, who, of course, famously remarked that inflation is first and foremost a monetary phenomenon. And if you create more money, then that will create more inflation. What we've got at the moment, of course, is a great deal of money creation, but it isn't moving. But if it were to, then things would change very rapidly. And so I think there might be an analogy here. When there is an underwater earthquake which produces a tsunami, if you're sitting on the beach of a nearby island, the first thing you see is the water retreating. And that's your warning. Get off the beach, because it's going to come back. I suspect that the deflationary environment that we have now will be replaced by a catastrophically inflationary environment sometime soon.
That's an interesting point, isn't it? I think in the medium term, I most probably would describe that at some point the only way out is to finally see some level of inflation, but that's likely through very poor policy actions that follow on from ineffectual policy actions we're seeing now. I'm not convinced that deflation as a reflection in people's trading risk is actually correct at this stage, mainly for the fact that when you look at the oil price move, what has been the consensus expectation from it? US growth. That has been coupled with the fact that when you think about the pricing that's still going into equity markets, especially into the US, is that earnings and earnings growth will be stable and a positive on the year. And most consensus forecasts, in fact, all consensus forecasts point to the markets being higher this year and for economic growth being in the region of 3% or even better in the US. Now, that may slightly be coming down as we speak, but generally, I don't think there's really anyone who believes that the central banks cannot offset deflation. And that still may be the biggest risk, is the fact that they are piling out money all over the world, and yet actually we are still moving towards goods deflation. The one place where there really is inflation, and back to why financial assets find it hard to be overly excited about, is that that's where inflation has been taking place for several years. And is it the point where that inflation has got to end?
So it's interesting, we're still with the binary outcome, right? We're trying to, inflation's going to come. No, it's deflation. I think it's, if we look at it over an investable time period, the question is, how do we get inflation without wage growth? I guess that's what I've been struggling with for a while. How do you have people actually buying stuff more expensive if their own salaries are not going up and there's still high unemployment? So that's what makes me think it's going to be difficult to have inflation, in the sense that something that's beyond 5% or something like this, which would really be interesting for the bond market. I would, on the other hand, if we look around the world, we're not having the same discussion in the US than in continental Europe than in Asia, as it relates to inflation. We have different things that are happening, and it's what creates opportunities. We have divergent monetary policy to some extent. The QE in Europe has a different shape and is coming much later than the one in the US. That's creating an effect on the euro that we're seeing and on the Swiss franc that we have just seen, which is creating volatility and therefore opportunities. And we may continue to have that environment for the year to come. And that's if there is something I can invest in, is the fact that we're going to diverge. Is inflation going to come before deflation? I think it will be interesting to capture the trend when it comes, whichever is the trend. But you have to be positioned for that possibility, I guess, before.
I think that's a very good point for America. And I you know, definitely don't believe that we're necessarily we're going to see inflation quickly. In fact, I would agree that the problem is actually that wages aren't getting stickier. And actually, you know, one of the policy goals has got to be to try and actually create some level of flow through to wages going up in the developed world. So we start to see some bid and taking out the supply in goods. You know, back to the point that financial assets have been bid up and have been inflated. You know, goods prices have been oversupplied around the world for many years, and still that hasn't been taken out, and it's still the issue that we face. And especially, you know, we can really tap onto some good political fun with talking about inequality and the way in which, you know, money is flowing or not flowing through the economic system today. And so really, again, it's offsetting the ability for inflation to develop in the short term. But I think, you know, to Richard's point, you know, at some stage, we are creating the environment, but it's going to come through policy mistake, and then all of a sudden saying money has to go into people's hands. We have to let wages go up. We have to even, you know, promote them aggressively. But we're nowhere near that yet.
On the subject of unemployment in Europe, Frau Merkel is fond of remarking that Europe has 20% of the world's population, but 80% of its welfare spending. She seems to trot this out as if it were a policy, but it's just a remark, of course. But it does reflect on why it is that we have such high unemployment in the Eurozone, especially in the southern countries of the Eurozone, whereby people under 25 are, in many of those countries, about 50% likely to have a job. Half of them are unemployed. And the reasons for that are not poor education, although they may be poorly educated, but largely the fact that those people who have jobs are protected, and those people who don't have jobs can't get into that protected sector. And so you have a structural problem in southern Europe, well, largely in Europe, but it shows up in the south, whereby high unemployment does not necessarily act as a check on inflation. And so the non-inflationary restricted rate of unemployment in, for example, Italy, is much, much higher than it would be in the States. Because if you get unemployment, if you get employment rates or unemployment rates down under 5% in the States, you start to worry about tightness in the labor market. But it's a much, much higher level anywhere in Europe.
Well, not everyone agrees with you in our little group, but then again, if we all agreed, we'd be economists. No, that's quite the opposite to the truth. Anyway, we will continue this in a few minutes. In the meantime, listeners, even before our imminent fundraising week from the 9th to the 15th of the month, how about supporting the station? Go to our website on www.resonancefm.com and make a secure donation. Keep the show on the road. Anyway, while I leave you with that thought, Mr. Chris Dixon, let's have some more music.
Welcome back to the Naked Short Club on Resonance FM. That was David Allen, whom we do wish better. Anyway, I am Dr. Stu, your host, and we are coming to you live from an Athens that is well on the way to economic good times. Borrow a lot, spend too much, don't pay your taxes, go bust and recover. Same as everywhere else. Nothing unique to hear. Anyway, listeners, once again, don't forget to tune in and support the Resonance Fundraiser Week from February 9th to 15th. There is an awesome array of events taking place, and you can bid on in our online auction. Some examples of lots are a meal for two at the Royal Academy of Art with two tickets to the Rubens exhibition, two tickets to Chelsea against Stoke City in April at Stamford Bridge, a Jeroboam of vintage champagne, a signed Didier Drogba t-shirt, a half day's expert careers counselling, artworks by the artists Bob and Roberta Smith and others, meals for two at two Dr. Stu favourites, Delfino's in Mayfair and Alma's in Borough High Street, one-to-one boxing training with a professional trainer in your home or office. So, from February the 9th to 15th, check out www.fundraiser@resonancefm.com. And mustn't forget that the Naked Nut Company of Visalia, California, Resonance FM's latest and tastiest corporate supporter, has donated no fewer than 10 large gift baskets of their crunch yum delicious nuts. Now let's round things off, starting with you, Eric.
So to continue with the train of thought that was interrupted by the music, the interesting discussion on what's happening in Southern Europe and to pick up on the introduction, the consequences it has on how people are voting or the type of governments that are coming in, which may force a change in policy, We see if it does within Europe, but it's certainly an evolution that could be very significant over the next few years. The generation that's voting now is the one that is unemployed and out of the market, and things may be flipped over. It will be interesting to see how that happens, and how we can trade that.
Yeah, I guess me and my fellow Greek countrymen have all just finished Piketty's book on inequality, which helped us all to vote for Spyriza. But I think there are links between the end of Bretton Woods, the money system, inequality, and what's happening today. So political volatility that we're seeing is not coincidental, and in fact I'm not even very convinced is directly linked just to what happened 7 years ago, but actually has a longer gestation period. So I am sort of, as we sit here finishing this this second or third coffee, sort of reaching some sort of idea that actually we might be at the end of the beginning in some sense of understanding where we are, which all goes all the way back to Andrew's initial opening thoughts as to, do we know where we are? Well, perhaps Greek voters are giving us a sense of where we are. And Andrew, I don't know if you, sort of you're coming along on that journey with me with that lovely coffee.
I think I'm going to that. As we tuck into the third coffee of the evening and feeling completely hyped, that maybe it is time to get very excited that we are at a phase where to pick up the comments on democracy, that we're seeing that raise its head. What comes from this? I think it increases uncertainty for some time. How that feeds back to good old financial markets, I think, is yet to be very easy to work out. But what I do think that is one of the consequences that we will see much more questioning of the current system, of current policy framework. What is the good that's come from the level of intervention, and how can we start to position policy to help the general society, and to get those unemployment levels down, start to get people earning better wages, and then start to see some positive feedback from that. The only part I would raise is back to the comments of a few minutes ago that if you start to impact on the real economy and change the dynamics there, what will it mean for the financial markets? And the reality is, I think we'll have transition through the course of months and years, but it certainly won't be the smooth environment that we've enjoyed for the last 5 to 6 years.
It's funny, isn't it? People all over the world seem to be very much the same. They work busily creating things. We're like termites on the African veldt, building our little mounds. And sometimes they build them very, very high, and then some unthinking wildebeest comes and crashes into it and the thing falls over. Something like Vladimir Putin, perhaps, would be the human analogy. But it's not always the reason for a termite hill collapse. Sometimes they just build crooked. They set off in a wrong direction. They start to tilt. They build a bit more. They tilt a bit more. And they fall of their own weight. And I think that we've just built something quite rotten. And I don't think it's yet fallen over. So I'm concerned that continued attempts to prop it up and return to some normality may be doomed.
Well, I have to say this is, if not the most interesting edition of the Naked Short Club in terms of the discourse within it. I found it fascinating that on the one hand, at least one of us is convinced that we're drinking coffee and not the delicious products of our corporate sponsors made of premium Ponzi beer. And another is talking about we're out in the middle of the veldt surrounded by large termite mounds. And that's probably because I'm not sure all of you were aware what those little blue pills that you slipped down your throats earlier were all about. Alpha pills, of course. Anyway, let's have some more poetry from Pelle before we go.
Thank you. The Pope has said this week that women having plastic surgery on their faces is a form of burqa for the skin. And I wrote a poem about 10 years ago about having something on the side of my face, a bee sting, which I think relates to it. Swelling. This new slow, shrill drum along the bone wakes something and digs in, and a new nudity comes, fevered, flushed, and shy. It's rude, revealing this face so scorched and high rising across the cheek, one famished oriental eye here on the weeping side, swelling, digs in. So I'm craving a veil for this wedding of swelling to skin, a red one for its burning visions long.
Pretty good, and certainly made a lot more sense than these rather weird plutocrats here. Anyway, good luck with you and your ill-gotten fortunes. Anyway, thanks, you great guests. Leandros Kalisperis, Pelle Cox, Richard Edwards, Eric Bissonnier, Andrew McCaffrey, and thanks as ever to Master Engineer Mr. Chris Dixon. And of course, thanks to our corporate sponsors, Made of Ponzi Beer, and to the Naked Nut Company of Visalia, California. Anyway, next week in Jerusalem, and in the meantime, leaving you with the sound of the pretty things, just remember, doing as you would be done by and loving kindness are all that really matter. The rest is just commentary. Easy.
station classic for classic rock and classic funk. That's quite a mix, but it's great for your ears. Listen up. You're going to stay with us. We're going to have all the hits and all the... Oh. Imagine that. Imagine a radio station. Resonance. 104.4 FM.